On this episode, I am thrilled to be joined by a former teammate of mine and an English footballing icon. He played over 700 professional games and won 78 England caps, earning one of the most famous nicknames in football. This is Stuart Pearce, also known as Psycho.
Piercy, great to see you.
Pleasure, John.
Your story isn't a normal footballing story, so take us back to the start.
I was never a child superstar like yourself, Joe. Finished schooling at the age of 16, played for a really good school team, Champions of London, but had nowhere to go and play my football at the age of 16. So I think five of us went down to our local club, which was Wealdstone, who were playing in the Southern League at the time, which was a league just outside the football leagues. Right. And I played in the youth team and reserves for a year and ended up staying there for 5 years, played 250 games. Yeah. And was fortunate at the end of that to get an opportunity in the pro game. But to be fair, I had to work the hard way. I'm an electrician by trade.
Yeah, we got onto that. Mm. But you had trials at QPR and you turned down an opportunity at Hull. Mm. So there was an opportunity to go pro.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from West London, so QPR are my local team. So at the age of 13, I ended up passing a trial and having 6 months with them. But they got rid of me after those 6 months and then nothing in the pro game. And then at the age, I think I was 18 at the time, and myself and the captain at Wealdstone went up to Hull on a trial game. I was doing an apprenticeship as an electrician at the time, and we played against Grimsby away in a trial match. Had about glamour 3 days. It was a proper glamour tie, you know what I mean? Suited me, Joe, suited me. The manager wanted to take both of us. The captain at the time, he was 27, turned it down because he was earning more money than going in the old fourth division.
Right.
And it just seemed a long way from home as an 18-year-old. They even offered me a job on Humberside Council to carry on my trade as an electrician and be a part-time footballer on a full-time basis up there.
If you said that story to some of the young players in the academy now, they'd think it was like a parallel universe, wouldn't they?
They would. I mean, to be honest with you, when I turned pro, I carried on trading. Yeah. I advertised in the programme and all sorts.
I've heard.
For a couple of years,
So you was moonlighting as an electrician?
Yeah, I just flipped it really, from sort of full-time sparks to part-time footballer and just turned it on its head and went part-time electrician.
That's an incredible story, you know. There was that period of your career, that must have been such a grounding. So eventually when you did get a move to Coventry, did you find, was the world of professional football, was it different to what you've been doing? Like, I would imagine still in them days, a lot of the players wouldn't have had a background or another job. Mm. So you still would have been an anomaly coming into the dressing room. Like you said, a full-time spark, and now you're playing for Coventry.
Yeah, I mean, you bear in mind how different it was then. I packed my job in on Brent Council. I was earning 280 quid a week, footballer as well as electrician. And I walked into Bobby Gould's office and he offered me a £30 wage cut to be a footballer in the top division in the country.
It's insane.
So
it's insane.
I'd already packed my job in, Joe, so I couldn't go back. Yeah. So I couldn't tell him no, you know, so I've had to take a wage cut to be a pro footballer. So that's why I carried on. In the top flight, top division in the country. A couple of weeks, I think 4 weeks after signing, we beat Liverpool at home 4-0 with the great Liverpool team.
I'm
thinking, this is just ridiculous, you know what I mean? I've had to take a wage cut to be part of this, but you had no choice.
So you go to Coventry, and just talk us through that jump from Wealdstone. It wasn't second division, third division, second division. You've gone straight up and you're playing against Liverpool. Well, did you find it? Obviously you found it difficult, but what was the big differences you found?
Training every day was difficult for me. I to adjust to that. We used to train, you know, Tuesday night, Thursday night, play Saturday. Yeah. I was rounded in regard to playing, and playing non-league in that division was physically aggressive as well. You know, it's a real tough place to play. You're playing against all ex-pros at places like Altrincham and Worcester and places like that. The travelling was similar because you're going up as far as Scarborough and places like that at the time. So you're doing the same travelling and stuff. But I was getting up in the morning at 7 o'clock to get back on the tools again. But training every day I found a little bit difficult, I've got to say, in the adjustment. But I was fortunate. I played one reserve game and played quite well in that.
Yeah.
And then went straight on the bench. So there was only one sub in those days. I was on the bench the following Saturday. So I'd only been at the club 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then a week after that, I think, I went straight in the first team, played particularly well against QPR, strangely enough, and stayed in the team, basically, from then on. So I was fortunate I hit the ground running in regard to performances and stayed in the team.
It must have been a bit of a kick in the teeth for QPR that they've got a player on their doorstep that they turned down and eventually popped up playing against them. Did you always have a... Obviously, you know, we played later on in your career, and you're renowned for your determination. Do you think your journey put that fire in your belly more so than other players? Did you, because you know you the way you played was wholehearted and full blooded. You know, did you think your grounding was a reason for that, or is that something that was just in you?
No, 100%. I think it was an amalgamation of both, really, Joe. You know, I think I had a little bit of that in me anyway, but also felt as though when I, you know, playing alongside people like yourself who were blessed with more talent than me, I always felt as though I had to work harder and maybe be more aggressive and be more professional than the other players, because they had more talent than I did. And that drove me. And it probably drove me to play an extra 5 years. Yeah. I didn't retire till I was 40 because of that 5 years beforehand.
Yeah, do you know what? It's just reminded me now something you said to me. I mean, I'm jumping forward. But when we played together, we had a chat once in the having breakfast. You talked to me about playing for England. I'd played a handful of times, and you said, when you play for England, you have to always remember you're playing for two caps. Yep. You've got to perform. You've got to perform in that game, so you get the cap the next time.
Yes.
You have to, you know. Yeah. And I thought, wow, like, you was 35, 36 at the time, and you was like, every time you step on the pitch, you had that desire, and that stuck with me. Mm. You know, because sometimes, as a player, particularly as a young player, football was easy to me. Mm. I didn't have to train as hard as the others. I did. I loved playing. I didn't like the gym and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that stuck with me. I thought, well, if Stuart Pearce has got that mindset, he's where I want to be. He's played 70-odd times for England. So that stuck with me. So it's, just reminded me of that now. So, but
that was always my proviso. Yeah. If you played well in any individual game for England, the manager can't leave you out the next one.
Yeah.
So it's almost as soon as you stepped on that pitch, for me, it was, I'm playing for two caps today. If I get today right, I've got another one coming.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what drove me on in many ways.
Yeah. The only time that didn't work for me, I scored the winner against Wales and I got dropped for the next game and I was kicking off. But yeah, you're right. Usually it does.
If I was your manager, I'd have left you in the team, Joe. Don't worry.
But ended up, you've gone to Coventry, you're playing in the top flight, you're an electrician. You was an electrician. Was there any funny, did any of the lads have any problems and you have to go and sort it out? Was there anything like that happened?
John Sillett collared me, and who was the reserve team manager at the time, and said, you know, christened me Sparksy at the time, he knew I was an electrician. So he said, could you come and have a look at my barn? I need some electricity down there. So I had to run an armoured cable 200 yards to his stables to put some electricity on that and whatever. And I mean, John passed away not so long ago, but really a great man, you know.
Yeah.
And to be fair, he was still calling me Sparksy.
I was at
Warwick Races once and I had a horse running there just to divert you with a story a little bit. And he asked me before the race, he said, what chance your horse got of winning today? I said, no, it's just here for the run, really, John. It won, and he chased me up the race course shouting, Sparksy, you couldn't tip a wheelbarrow, son. This was a few years later, but I'd done his, Kirk Stevens, done some wiring there, Peter Barnes put some lights up at his place. So I was working, but one or two of the other boys in the dressing room as well were Mickey Adams and Nicky Platner.
Yeah.
They bought a flatbed lorry. They're doing garden clearances, Joe. You know, there was a few people in the dressing room were actually, you know, doing bits and pieces to supplement their wages.
You get the move after 2 years, Piercy. 1985, Nottingham Forest come calling, the legendary Brian Clough. And you've got to give some context. Some of the younger people going to Nottingham Forest at that time was probably the equivalent of going to a Man City, Liverpool. They were, they'd just won European Cups 4 years before. What was that like? And, you know, talk to me about Brian Clough.
I think when you I probably signed for Brian Clough more than Nottingham Forest at the time.
Right.
Obviously, I stayed at Forest subsequently for 12 years, Joe, and got a love of the football club then. But originally, when Brian Clough picks the phone up and he wants you to come and sign for him, you're signing for him.
Yeah.
He was probably the biggest character in football. And I would say he's probably the biggest character there's ever been in football, personally. You know, what he achieved on the pitch with lesser light teams, if you like, with Derby, with Forest and whatever. So meeting him, you're scared stiff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's this reputation of a fella there. My first conversations I had with him, I was asked by a coach. I was walking up to the ground one day playing for Coventry. We were playing Liverpool back end of the season, and a fella come up alongside me and said, do you want to come and play for Nottingham Forest? I didn't know this fella from Adam. And I was walking to the game, you know. It was about an hour and a quarter before the game, and I said, yeah, I wouldn't mind. My contract was due to finish at the end of that season at Coventry, and I'd been there 18 months. And I said, So he said, give us your number, we'll give you a ring. So I've give this total stranger my telephone number. It was bizarre when I look back, you know, how naive I was. A couple of days later, the phone went. It was the same fella who happened to be on the coaching staff and just said, I've got Brian Clough here. He wants to talk to you.
Yeah.
So I'm nervous as a kitten going on the phone, Joe.
Yeah.
Picked the phone up and he said, it's Brian Clough. Do you want to play for me, son? And I went, yeah, I wouldn't mind. And he slammed the phone down. That was it. That was the whole conversation. And about 3 months later, he come and paid $200,000 for me.
Hold on, so 3 months later, well, there must have been some conversation between then and there. Nothing?
Nothing at all. Nothing. The only thing that happened prior to that, I was a Coventry player playing at the City Ground against Forest.
Yeah.
And I got a blow on my leg and I went down injured. And as I looked up, the physio got to me.
Right.
But it weren't the Coventry physio, it was a Forest physio. And he ran on and he said, how old are you, son? And I said, I'm 22.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, I'm lying down injured at the time and not one of these players. He went, cheers, and run off again. And I thought, this is just bizarre. But Cluffy had sent him on. Because he hadn't seen me probably and thought, I don't know this kid. How old is he? Sent the physio on, asked me how old I was. Physio run on, how old are you? And off he went again.
Well, nice to know he's done his due diligence on the signing.
Just left me there, exactly that.
I mean, you had some incredible times. You know, two League Cup triumphs. I remember actually coming to watch you at Nottingham Forest when I was at the national school, I was 14. And you used to do this thing where you used to just, did you punch the post at one end before a game to get the crowd going?
Yeah.
Or was that a regular thing?
Yeah,
Because I remember all the lads, he's going to do it, And then doing all the crowd would respond. Mm. You had a special relationship with them fans, didn't you?
Really good. I've got to say, they were fantastic to me. It grew, it didn't develop straight away, Joe, you know what I mean? I had to sort of win them over. But after 1 year, I ended up being the captain of the club, you know. And I never went out for a warm-up before games. When I was at Coventry, I walked in the dressing room at Coventry and an old pro there, Kenny Hibbett, was there. And we always used to go out and warm up. That's what I'd done on the league. And Kenny never used to go out.
Right.
And you know what it's like? You hang on every word of the experienced pros. I said, Kenny, why don't you go out?
Yeah.
He said, I get paid for an hour and a half. I ain't doing any more. This is what he said to me. So I thought, well, if it's good enough for you, I'm not going out. So I used to stay in the dressing room and warm up and used to do that at Forest. But when I went out, I always likened it to a boxer. You never see a boxer go in the ring, warm up, come back out and go in. When they go in, they go in once and they're ready. And I used to do a really stringent warm up on the clock. But when I went out, straight over to the home fans, and it was almost a bit of theatre in some ways. Got me at it and got them at it as well.
You certainly got the fans at it. We enjoyed it. And I said, I don't know, it must have been 96, 97, but you had some League Cup triumphs. And talk to me about them nights. Because like you said, from the aspect, you're playing non-league at Willesden and all of a sudden you're lifting trophies with Nottingham Forest. Mm. That must have, did there any point that you pinched yourself, or was you just in the mix or in the carry on going? Was you just always striving for success?
I think in many ways, Joe, I'm very grounded and very level, and it's, as you mentioned before, it's that working background has put me in that, and that mentality that I was never as good as everybody else. So I always had to say, I've got to try harder, be more professional. So I've never really got washed away with celebrity in football. It's not what I do. So for me, it was brilliant. Every day you're trying to strive. Every time I took the pitch, I thought, if I play as well as I can, I'll be the best player on the pitch. And that's what I tried to do all the time. And to be honest with you, I was fortunate enough to work for a manager in Brian Clough that kept you really, really grounded.
Yeah.
You know, my first great example of that, my first England call, I was so excited. I think in, what was it, not 87, I got picked. And Kenny Sansom was injured at the time, the left back, so I knew I had a chance of playing. Yeah. And the two games coming up at the end of the season were Brazil and Scotland. So fantastic games to start your career. But I was nervous as a kid, and are you good enough to step into that sort of realms of playing? It weren't club football now. These are the top players, and it's Shilton and Robson and icons of the game, you know? And Cluffy called me in the following day and said, I see you're in the England squad, son. And I said, that's right. He said, do you think you're good enough? I said, I'm not sure. He went, I don't, get out. And I'm his captain at the time, you know. And it was his way of just keeping me level and saying, hey, we pay your wages, keep your feet on the ground. But great motivation for me, Joe, because I thought the nerves I had of playing for England, I had someone to prove wrong.
And I think in life,
if you've got someone to say, I can prove you wrong, it's not a bad thing.
You know what, that's something I share when under Mourinho. I think it's something to do with, I don't know if it's the working class background or where it was, but I always played better when I thought, I'll show you to the manager. I wasn't a player. I think people think flair player, because you need a arm around you and all that. I always felt better, like anger, and I wanted to prove someone right, someone wrong. So yeah, that's interesting, that is. I mean, you had a great time. Love-hate relationship with Wembley. You scored, for a particular, was it 1990?
91. Yeah.
Was it Gazza, the injury?
Yeah.
Nottingham Forest, Gary Charles. Talk to me about that day, because I particularly remember that day. Gazza was my hero. But yeah, talk to me about that day from a Forest perspective.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of went on a really good run. I think it was 88 the first time we got to the League Cup final. And we went to the League Cup final 3 years running. We won the first two and got beaten in the third one. And we were getting, we went to two FA Cup semi-finals and were beaten by Liverpool. And then managed to get to the final that year against Tottenham. And it was the one trophy Cluffy had never won, Joe. You know, so when you look back what he's done, he's won leagues, he's won back-to-back European Cups. He'd done all that in the glory team at Nottingham Forest. For us as a new generation of Forest players, we were desperate to deliver that trophy for him that he'd never got his hands on. So it was a really big one for us. And to be fair, Gazza's gone into the game for the first 15 minutes. He made two of the worst challenges you've ever seen.
You played, we'll get onto England and stuff later, but could you see in that game that because his eyes were wild, from watching it, he looked wild. Could you see? Did you play on that effectively? Probably knew you could. I'll be trying to wind him up, trying to get him sent off. He did the tackle on. Was it Gary Charles the first one or Gary Steve? Gary Parker.
Gary Parker. Yeah, the first one was poor.
He was insane in that game.
Yeah, it was incredible. How he never got sent off, we'll never know. Two of the worst tackles you've seen, but it is what it is. I love Gazzett a bit. Yeah. Some like you, anyone who spent time with him, you just got to love him and have affection for him. But he was one player that you know in their ranks, they had Lineker up front, but they've got Gazza in midfield. So you've got two top quality players. One can get you a goal, the other one can win a game at the drop of a hat.
And
to be fair, we were delighted to see him go off. Obviously, you didn't want a long-term injury with him, but he went off. We scored from the subsequent free kick. And to be fair, I would say, looking back at the game now, Joe, from that moment on, we didn't play. We just held on to it, or tried to hold on to a lead. And it wasn't a great game, and in the end it ended up fizzling out, and it wasn't to be for us on that day, but we didn't play well enough on that day, and Spurs probably got a lift from Gazza going off in many ways.
Sometimes it's the siege mentality, you know, he sticks in and anyway. But I mean, can we talk about, you played in the game, the semi-final, I think the year being 89, the Hillsborough game.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been just heart-wrenching. Did you have an idea what was going on outside and what was that like?
Yeah, it was surreal, Joe, I've got to say. It was, We'd started the game. I think Peter Beardsley had hit the woodwork early on in the game. And after about 4 minutes, fans were coming over the Leppin Lanes end. And the referees stopped the game and taken us off the pitch. And literally, as a player, it was incredible. We went in the dressing room. So you're talking 3 minutes past, 5 minutes past three. We're in the dressing room and we didn't come out the dressing room again until we got on the coach for probably 3 hours maybe. And it was quite surreal. I went home that night, got home, and it was almost, we were being drip fed information from outside on the pitch, that type of thing. You know, one or two people have got injured. The game might not restart. And your mentality as a footballer is, this is a massive game for us. This is a semi-final against Liverpool, the FA Cup. And you've got that mentality. So you're trying to keep in the professional mode of making sure you keep yourself warm. You think the game's going to restart. All of those things are going on in your mind. And then you're hearing other things. One or two people have been injured, you're hearing. Next thing, probably an hour and a bit later, there's been a fatality. And all of these things are being drip-fed into the dressing room area. And I went home that night, and honestly, Joe, it was like watching a scene from another country. All the scenes on the pitch were being shown on television. And it was as though almost I wasn't there. You know, all I saw was a few people coming over a barrier, and then we were all off the pitch. And then I arrived home to watch this on television and the horrific scenes. And obviously the outcome of it was just incredible. But for us, it was just, it was a really surreal day. And they were doing interviews with the police and everything. And almost, for me, it was a case of, you're better off interviewing relatives that are in the stand. They saw it all pan out in front of them. Not us as players in many ways, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a massive tragedy. And you know, I played for Liverpool later on in your career. You speak to Kenny about it, and the Liverpool players took a lot. A lot of burden. They took a lot, you know, like Kenny was going to all the funerals, you know, and it was it's interesting your perspective on the day, but it's a horrible day.
It was for both teams, I think, in some ways it united both teams. The rearranged game that took place at Old Trafford was almost, it was flat as a pancake from a footballing perspective, you know, because of what had gone on beforehand. And to be fair, it's, if anything, Joe, if anything good can come out of it, it's the fact that safety around grounds from that incident is improved tenfold.
Well, it's not happened since, you know, so that's the positive. BT Sport Pods. So your career at Nottingham Forest, it ends, Brian, you know, it ends relegation. I mean, I've suffered relegation in my career, and at a club that I love, West Ham. It must have been really, really tough for you for it to end that way. But I don't know, how old was you at that time?
I think I was 33.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
It
was a tough, it was very tough. That's, the whole season was awful for us. We were destined to go down from start to finish. People saying that we're too good to go down. That wasn't the case. In the subsequent year or two beforehand, we'd sold Des Walker, Neil Webb had gone, Roy Keane had gone, Nigel Clough had gone. So too many good players had walked out the door.
Why was that?
Listen, when you get the opportunity to join Manchester United or the bigger teams at the time with Roy's opportunity and one or two others, a lot of people jumped at that. I mean, I was probably one of the ones that enjoyed where I was working and turned down opportunities to go to bigger clubs because I was enjoying my football. I enjoyed where I lived and worked. The club had been good to me.
Did you have opportunities? There must have been opportunities to go.
Yeah, probably the two big ones for me were Rangers in Scotland when they were paying big money and Suey was in charge, and Manchester United in about 1990, I think it was. But at the time at Forest, we were winning more than they were, which is hard to believe at the time. United hadn't won anything for a number of years, and Forest, we were League Cup final 3 years running, to FA Cup semi-finals, FA Cup final. All of those things were ticking along, and more importantly for Joe, for me, Joe, I was playing for England, and that meant more to me than anything. And I've seen too many of our players leave Forest, Gary Birtles, and go to Man United or go to other clubs and their form dip. And I weren't prepared to let that happen to me.
I mean, yeah, you're synonymous with Forest, but you're synonymous with England. We will get onto that. But, you know, you moved on, you went up to Newcastle and you played with the likes of John Barnes, Ian Rush. And I think Kenny was the manager at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, how was that? I mean, you had a hell of a team up there as well.
I walked in the dressing room, Joe, and Les Ferdinand, Alan Shearer, Asprilla, Beardsley, well, you name it, David Batty, Rob Lee, a host of top quality players were in the dressing room, and they had just finished second in the league the year before. So the opportunity for me to go and join them was just incredible, you know. So, as I say, they were in the Champions League, so it's Champions League football that I hadn't played in. So it was a fantastic opportunity for me at the right age and at the right time, I think, to leave Forest at the time, you know.
Yeah, did you play in the famous, was it the Barcelona game?
I played in the away leg, but I didn't. I was injured for the home leg, and Asprilla got a hat-trick that day. Yeah. And I've got to say, it's probably one of the best individual performances I've ever seen in my life. He was incredible. Yeah. He ripped them to bits. And, you know, every time I bump into someone and we talk about Newcastle, they mention exactly that one game and that one performance. And he was an interesting character.
Yeah. His stories on the pitch and off the pitch go above him. But, I mean, you had the taste of the Champions League, the FA Cup final again in 98 against the great Arsenal side with the young Nicolas Anelka and that. I mean, the FA Cup was the one that got away for it, because it's so important for, I say our generation, you're older than me, but the FA Cup was the one trophy that I wanted to win, even more so than the Champions League.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that day, was it 2-0?
Yeah. We were well beaten by Arsenal on that, I've got to say. I mean, I was probably fortunate in some ways. The two years I was at Newcastle, they got to the final on both occasions, know, which was good. The second year, I didn't contribute a great deal to that, but the first year certainly did. And, it was... I think when you're born in, probably when I was, the FA Cup has got real glitz to it, you know, and to have the opportunity. But Arsenal had an outstanding team, you know, and it had all the superstars, the Invincibles and whatever, and they were by far better than us on the day.
Yeah, I remember. So it gets to 99, and our paths cross. And I think, you know, it was exciting for me as a young player when you come in. And like I said, I told you the story about the two caps which stuck with me. And also, so we're playing together, and one of the other stories, which again I took into my career, we played against Tottenham in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup, and you had an ankle injury, and I think Harry was like, well, Piercy's not going to play because it was blown up like that. And you come into the dressing room, John Green was there, and you put your ankle out, and I must say, it was the ugliest ankle I've ever seen. It was swollen, like, it looked like the Elephant Man's ankle, and you just went, just cut me boots and inject it and play. And I couldn't believe it. It was black and blue. And we went, you scored the free kick. I think I won the free kick. And we whipped the free kick in. We went 1-0 up against Spurs. And I was just like, that's a proper man. Do you know, like, and you're learning the game. You're learning what it's about to be a professional footballer. And I was like, you know, playing with you was important for me, because I learned so much. I played in front of you and you taught me through the game, and I'd never experienced that. And I took that into my career. So when I become a senior player, I always wanted to be a good role model for the young players. I mean, did you at that stage of your career, did you come into our young dressing room? Did you take that on board? Is that something that just come naturally?
100%. I think, going back to when I was a young player and a non-league player, You look up to your captain at the time. Yeah. My captain was John Watson, who used to play at Wildstone, and was a great role model and an influence on me. And then that goes on. So I can tell you stories about Kenny Hibbert at Coventry. Yeah. Then I walked into the Forest dressing room, and Ian Bowyer was the captain at the time, who you look up to and hang on their words.
Yeah.
And you start to work out, right, this is how I conduct myself as a senior pro. So when Harry Redknapp gives me the opportunity to come and join West Ham at Well, I was 37 at the time, by the way, and that's taking a punt on an old player, and I hadn't played for 8 months, Joe.
Really?
And he said to me, look, I've got it over the line. It was 8 days before the season started, and we were due to play Tottenham.
Yeah.
And he rang me up and said, I've got it over the line with the chairman. When you walk through the door as a senior player, yes, you've got to deliver performances, but also as well, you've got to be a great role model for them because the manager's backed you.
Yeah.
So how I conduct myself on the training pitch as a player and off the training pitch as well is really important. And that, cause I've got to send those messages out to you as the next generation of a captain, if you like. Yeah. And that game was incredible, the quarter final. We had a really good run in the cup. Yeah. We went away at Sunderland and won. Then we won at Manchester United and we thought, you know what, we could have a squeak here.
Yeah.
And on the Wednesday before the game on Saturday, we played Chelsea at home in the league. And Harry said, look, I'm going to rest a couple. I said, look, I'd rather play. I prefer the rhythm of playing.
Yeah.
And I ended up rolling my ankle and had to come off. And the ankle was literally ballooned up. So Harry ripped me off for a couple of days. And so I said to John Green, the physio, I said, what chance have I got of getting through the game? I said, I don't like strappings. He said, if you don't strap this, you'll never, ever get through the game.
Yeah.
So I said, all right, do it. He said, I've got to glue the strapping on because it can't possibly come loose.
Yeah.
So he's ended up putting this, I don't know, Gorilla glue on it or something like that. Yeah. And he's put a strapping on it. I've got through the game, but he said, we're going to have to change it at half time because if there's any leeway at all, you're done.
Yeah.
So I come in at half time and Jess Steinberg's the doc.
Yeah.
Put his scissors inside the strapping. It was so tight, Joe, he thought he was putting his scissors inside the strapping. He was actually trying to put it inside my skin to cut it off. It was that tight. So in the end, he's got it off. We've restrapped it again and managed to get through the game. But it was one of those that it was touch and go.
Going back to the game I played in front of you, we changed systems to a 4-4-2. And I was playing in front of you on the left. And I'd never played, believe it or not, I'd never played in a 4-4-2 on the left because we played a 3 most of the time. And you talked me through the game and I remember thinking, God, he's not letting me move here. I was in front of you, I was blocking lanes, I was doing all the right things defensively. But then you went, go on, go. And ended up was playing Southampton or Derby or someone. And I sort of was really rigid, and I was never rigid, I was all over the place as a player. But then I ended up getting the goal, and it stuck with me about, you know, being disciplined defensively, helping out your fullback, blah, 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 you know what I mean? And I took that in, which helped me later on in my career. So,
I think as an old head, you've got to come in. I was really fortunate that at that stage of my career, I had the likes of you with your energy and whatever, and Rio alongside me and young Frank and Michael Carrick, some really great young talent. But I would be missing a trick as a person if I didn't use, A, my experience to help you to make you flourish, and secondly, not do that just to protect myself as part of the team and help you as players. And I think it's like now, it's probably why I've gone into coaching and management, because you want to help others and see them improve.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Anyway, you won Hammer of the Year. You know, you was brilliant. The West Ham fans fondly remember you from your playing. Although you're 37, you carried on going again to Manchester City. 2001, you dropped down the league.
Yeah.
And you ended up winning the title with them. And what, you must have been 39 or 38, Piercy. I mean, was there opportunities to carry on after that, or was you done?
Well, Harry Redknapp had left West Ham. I was 39 years old. My contract had finished. The club said to me, I had an interest in going into management, so I sort of half muted, look, you know, I put my name in as manager, and they said, look, we need someone with more experience, but if you want to hang around a little bit till the new manager comes in, he might need you as a player. So I thought, well, the last thing a new manager needs is a 39-year-old player hanging around. So I said, no, you're fine. So I thought I was going to retire from football at 39. Right. And Kevin Keegan rang me and said, I've just got the Manchester City job. You're going to be my first signing. I want you to come in as the captain, first signing. And I said to him, look, I'm looking to go into management and coaching. He said, well, you can be a coach as well. You can do that here while you're playing. So I said, okay. So off I went. From thinking I'm going to retire, I went up to Manchester City and had an absolute incredible year with Kevin. You know, fantastic man. Him and Arthur Cox were the management team. And they were brilliant to me. I was able to sort of help do my coaching badges whilst playing. I think I played 44 matches that year for Man City and 44 the year before. So when I hear players now saying we need rest and whatever, at the age of 39 and 40, I ended up playing 88 games. So and we won the division with 100 plus points, and it was just a brilliant way of bailing out. We got promoted back into the Premier League. And for me, that was probably the time I physically could have gone on.
Yeah.
But with the likes of Anelka waiting for you in the Premier League, it was probably wise to step away and stayed on the coaching staff there.
That's incredible. I mean, incredible journey. But it's, we can't have you on here without talking about England. You know, synonymous. Let's go back to the debut in 1987 against, was it Brazil?
Yeah.
Well, listen, they give you a nice easy start just to ease you into to football. What, who was playing for Brazil that day?
I was playing up against a fella called Muller, and Mirandina, who was playing for Newcastle at the time, was a centre forward. And I was fortunate enough to have, well, two great leaders playing inside me in Butcher and Adams, you know, that they played that day.
Is that the hardest back? That's got to be the hardest back four we've ever had. You, Butcher, Adams. Who was right back?
Gary Stevens, I think, at the time. Yeah, it wasn't a shy Irish retiring back line, let's say, with Shilts behind you. That if you stepped out of line with Shilts, you knew exactly where you stood. So, but 100,000 people at Wembley. I used to work at Wembley as a 14-year-old kid in the bars and stuff, because that's the borough I grew up in and went to school in and that type of thing. So I knew Wembley really well. But to have your debut for England at any time is memorable. To have it against the great Brazil at Wembley was brilliant. And it was just fortunate that it went reasonably well. And that old proviso again, you're playing for two caps. I played well enough in that to keep me place to go to Hampden and play Scotland in the next game. But yeah, great experience.
And you missed 1988 Euros through injury. That must have been tough.
Yeah, it was. As I say, I'd sort of had about a year around the squad, being understudy to Kenny, and had the odd game. And then I think I got a knee injury, I think, sometime in the April, and I would have been in the squad to go to the Euros in 88 in Germany, but missed the cup because of injury, and which was a real blow. It was a tournament that slipped past, but I'm not kidding myself, I probably wouldn't have played a great deal. Kenny was by far the best left-back in the country at the time, and he played and went, but after that, I think Kenny stepped away from it and I had a clear run as the left back.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes into 1990. That was the tournament. I was sitting there as a nine-year-old. Mm. And I remember, again, Gazza, and watching yourself. I fell in love with football and realised that's what I wanted. I want to play for England. So talk to me about that tournament. Because from my perspective, it is the tournament. Like, I was just, everything about it, the music, the way that it was on the telly, the way it was filmed, the team, Gazza, Waddle. Obviously, Brian Robson got injured, Lineker, a bit like Beardsley. It was just an amazing, what an amazing team and amazing time to be playing for England.
Yeah, when I look back now, Joe, it was almost the gateway between what football was like before that, you know.
It was
just, you know, certain people used to go to football. And then all of a sudden, after 1990, it became popular to the masses.
Yeah.
You got musicians that were all had a team at that stage. Yeah. Before that, they had no interest in football. Yeah. All of a sudden, after 1990, there was people who wanted to go with their families because of all the things that it encompassed. And probably you've got to look at the likes, you know, Des Walker come on the scene then, Platy come on the scene then. And more importantly, Gazza, you know, Gazza with his personality, with his performances, with everything that went with him. And I was seeing myself really fortunate that my time went hand in hand with Gazza's time in the England team. You know, for me, apart from Bobby Charlton, he's been the best we've ever had, you know. So it was brilliant, a great tournament. And my first and only World Cup. I never went to another one. I was an international for 12 years, but never went to another World Cup. That was the only one. We missed the cut in 94, 98. I dropped out of the squad just before it was picked with Glenn. So you've always got, and I never knew what a World Cup would look like. You know, when you've never, I've never been involved, you know, three and a half years earlier, I was an electrician. Then all of a sudden, it's the first tournament I've ever been to as a player, you know, youth football, young England missed me by. And then you don't know what to expect, and all of a sudden you tick along. We didn't play particularly well in the earlier rounds, but as it went on, momentum grew.
Yeah.
And it was just incredible. We come back to Luton, there was 250,000 people lining the streets to welcome us back, you know. Yeah. And a lot of that was down to Gazza and how he grabbed everyone.
Sport pods. That is a turning point in English football.
Yeah.
I think probably the people who bought the Premier League probably that was probably sparked their interest. They seen what it can mean. You know what I mean? So that is incredible. I mean, we've got to talk about the penalty.
Mm.
Talk to me about that, because I've had some dreadful luck with England and penalties. Like, I've never actually taken one. Champions League final. I was taken off for a Anelka to take one, because he was a natural penalty taker. Yeah. I'd never taken a penalty in my career. I played in teams where other players took them. But you has always been a penalty taker. Mm. So talk to me about that moment before, and after, and the Wadler, and just that whole moment.
Yeah, we sort of, by the time you get to knockout stages in those days, there was a bit of ad hoc practice, but not real in-depth practice, so I knew that if we go to penalties, I'm going to offer my services to take one. That's non-negotiable. And just made my mind up, Joe, really, just to go down the middle with some pace and hammer, and the goalie, credit to him, kept his feet there and got in the way of it, and they took some fantastic penalties. But where I always find that, and I always try to do this in life, if you get a bit of adversity somewhere, you've got to look and say there's a plus in there somewhere. I got pulled in for a drugs test, me and Schiltz, with the England. I walked in having missed a penalty, which was the lowest moment of my career ever, and went in the dressing room, and there was a lot of tears with all the players, and it was Bobby Robson's last game, and we knew that we had a chance of delivering something big for him, which we missed out on. And I got called into the drugs test, walked into a room, two German players sat down, and myself and Schiltz walked in, give a urine sample and walked out again. And just myself and two German players sat in a room like you and I across. They didn't say a word to each other for about an hour and a half. Neither of us could give a sample for that length of time. Yeah. We had to keep drinking water. And they didn't say a word. And subsequently afterwards, I thought, wow, what would this have looked like if there was two England players who had just won a semi and one German?
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, that's how to be humble in success. And it really taught me a big lesson that day. It was a tough one to swallow, I've got to say. You know, you think you've let your country down. Mm. And when we arrived back in Luton, the rest of the squad were all quite buoyant, and thought they'd done reasonably well and that type of thing. And myself and Chrissy were sort of just wanted to go home under a cloud and start the season again with our clubs. And that was, the following season was my best season as a player, because every ground I went to, I got dogs abuse, Joe.
Right.
Which really inspired me. Which, I think, once again, if you've got something to prove to people. Yeah. And it taught me a great lesson. Like when I took over the under-21s, I ended up thinking to myself, there's no way these young players can go through a similar scenario to what I did, being ill-prepared for a penalty shootout. Yeah. So we practised every day, 2 years out, after every training session, we practised penalties. Yeah, we collated all of the info on it. Joe Hart's, statistically, has faced 350 penalties in my care. I know his save ratio is 17%.
Yeah.
I know James Milner's scoring ratio is 83%.
Yeah.
Because we've done all the practice.
Yeah,
so when, it's fortunate for me, I think it was something like 19 years later, our under-21s went to a final, went to a penalty shootout, and statistically, we'd done all the work and we'd won a penalty shootout. So made it an exact science.
I mean, that, again, you're learning lessons through adversity. It's a great lesson for young
Very
people.
Much.
And you talk about, redemption. In 96 rolls around, again, another one that sticks in my mind, another massive moment. And probably, all the great, all the goals you scored, all the great performances you've put in for England and all your clubs, but your iconic moment is when you got redemption and, footballing redemption. I mean, like you said, you're probably doing a job, but I just think watching you celebrate and score after that was like, it was amazing from an England fan's perspective. And That was, it's an iconic moment in English football.
I think it was not just for me, but a lot of people that had done the journey. You mentioned earlier that the impact that the 1990 World Cup had on you as a young person coming in, loving football and whatever, and how it gripped you. And I think a lot of those people in the stadium that day had been on the same journey as me.
Yeah.
So when the ball was put on the penalty spot and I was walking up to take a penalty, you could feel the tension around the stadium. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was nervous, make no mistake, you always are. But I had a feeling that the relief when the ball hit the back of the net was felt by everybody that was supporting England in the stadium that day. You know, it was as though, thank goodness he scored and not missed, you know. But the big thing for me, Joe, was I knew that there was no defined taking order. You knew Shearer was going to take a penalty and maybe Teddy, but apart from that, there was no talk of who's taking a penalty or what.
Yeah.
And I knew that I had to get to Terry, the manager, and say, I'm going to take the third penalty. Mm. And
what was his reaction?
Are you sure? Was the first thing he said. I went up to him and said, I'm taking number three. And he just looked at me and went, are you sure? There was an expletive in there as well, Joe, but I've distanced myself from that. Yeah. And I went, I am. Well, I was before you said that, you know, there we were. So I think he was just pleased that one of the decisions on who were the five was solved. And he went, OK, fine.
Yeah.
And I look now and you talk about, I speak with companies about adversity and stuff like that. And I always think that it's the not trying or not putting yourself up, whether you're successful or not, in some ways is a little bit irrelevant. And that's sort of how I looked at it. I thought, if I stand on the halfway line and send Ince up or Tony Adams or whatever, players that are not penalty takers.
Yeah.
And for me to stand on the halfway line, I probably couldn't live with myself, Joe, to be honest.
To be fair, that's probably why England fans love you so much because we all went on that journey and it ended with that moment. And then, incredible. So, you know, your England career, 70-odd caps. Mm. You're a legend of the game for England. You've hung your boots up. And, you know, people would have said you'd gone in straight into coaching. You went in there and you went in City during a transitional period of the club. You know, it must have been similar, I would imagine, at that time because the money was starting to roll in. I mean, how was that with your coaching career starting?
I was really fortunate to have a mentor like Kevin Keegan and Arthur Cox at Manchester City that taught me how to conduct yourself as a coach, as a manager and as a person in many ways as well, you know. And I always had that mentality, Joe, that no matter what I've done in football is irrelevant, that's finished, throw it away.
Yeah.
You're starting from day one and you've got to get out. I probably started doing my coaching badges when I was doing them with Tony Carr at West Ham United, who helped me greatly there. I was doing them at Newcastle as well and at Manchester City. Mm. So I had a mentality that said I'm going to leave no stone unturned to be as good as I possibly can. So from doing every coaching badge that was available to going to one of the inaugural Warwick Business School business studies, from learning Italian, working with Fabio, from going to psychology courses and whatever, I'd go on every course available to me.
Yeah.
Because I just had that mentality, I've got to start again in a new career and prove myself.
And I
was really fortunate. I had a good chairman at Manchester City that when Kevin decided to step down, I used to, with Kevin, Kevin said to me, come into the board meetings with me, learn what it's like to be in a board meeting. And you never get a chance to be in a board meeting unless you're the manager. That's the first time you walk into a board meeting. And he was fantastic with me. Mm. He said, come into the board meetings, learn how it is. I used to go in with a chief exec, Alistair McIntosh, in the afternoons and go through the business side of Manchester City. So I knew when I took over as manager, I knew the club were in financial ruin, to be honest with you.
Was this before?
Before. So I was sacked the day it got taken over
by the
new Thai owners. So literally, the club had sold Sean Wright Phillips to Chelsea for 21 million in the first pre-season I started. Yeah. We lost Anelka 6 months before that, so two of the biggest goal scorers in the team had gone. But it was fantastic to work with the players there. We were managing the books a little bit.
Yeah.
I think in the two and a half years I managed Manchester City, we ended up recouping £13 million rather than spending the big money.
It's interesting you say that because people judge managers, and there's so many ways of judging a manager nowadays. There's certain clubs that are not trying to go on and do it. It's how you know, are they developing players? You know what I mean? So there's all, you know, like you said, you've come into Manchester City at a real difficult. Any manager coming in when a club's got no money, you're always up against it. So what a grounding that must have been for you. But you end, inevitably, you end your career in. Goes full circle back with England. You take over the England job in 2007. You had some great players. You had Mark Noble, James Milner, and you had a lot of success. I mean, did you feel that was, going back to work for the FA in England, did you feel that was your most comfortable, or not most comfortable, but your where you was
I was most probably happy. The most proudest.
Proudest,
I would
yeah.
say. One of the most proudest, yeah. I've got to say. I was fortunate that during the last 6 months of my tenure at Manchester City, Trevor Brook in the FA come to me and said, we need someone to take the under-21s to the finals that they've qualified for this summer. So I said yes before Manchester City had opportunity to say no, if truth be known.
So
I was doing both jobs. I was managing Manchester City, but also prepping the under-21s. So at the end of that season, I ended up losing my job at Manchester City when the new owners come in because they wanted Sven-Goran going in to take over Manchester City, so which was fine. And I concentrated on the under-21s and had six brilliant years at four major tournaments, which was fantastic for me. As you say, you're working with the best players in the country, you've got the best facilities in the country. I used it as well to improve myself as a coach and manager. I used to go in all the clubs and watch training and meet the managers and that type of thing. And it was just a wonderful learning curve really for me and a very proud moment because I knew what it meant for me to play for England. So I had to pass that mentality on to the players as well and try and get it more professional. I've got to say, one of the first jobs I had to do was put a presentation on Trevor. Trevor asked me to go into the board, the committee at the FA, and say, could you do a presentation on why we should build the National Football Centre?
Right, really?
And I said, I've got to do that as an under-21 manager. They should be telling me why they're building National Football Centre to improve the squad. But anyway, I said, of course I will. Yeah, it's part of my job. So within 3 months of being at the FA, I had to stand in front of the committee and say, this is why we need to build it, because of this, because of that, give reasons behind it, put a solid business argument up to it as well.
Yeah.
And for me, it was fantastic. I was at St George's Park a couple of days ago, Joe, and just to look around now, and you look in this 10 years that we've just had, the under-17s being champions, under-20s champions, the senior team going to a major final and semi-finals, and you think all of that somewhere down the line has something to do with St George's Park being built.
100%.
You know, so, and the teams being together, the togetherness and everything, which is fantastic to see. Yeah. And you think if you played a little part in that being built, all well and good.
Yeah, no, well, you've played a massive part in it, you know, because yourself, Dan Ashworth, I think there's a whole story to be told around the birth of St George's Park and the success we're seeing now.
Yes.
We're producing, we're playing the right way. I mean, I've got a thing where for so many, during my career, and maybe your career as well, although your teams were more successful than ours, it, for England, you know, give or take penalty shootouts, but I still felt that we were behind tactically.
Mm.
And I think we've caught up now. We've surpassed a lot of countries tactically.
Sure.
We're producing players like Foden, Grealish, Maddison, who can really handle the ball at international level. And there wasn't and there wasn't enough, I don't think, tactical knowledge from certainly in my career and players I played with, great players, legends of the game. But the system that's been put in place, I think has really helped us. So I think it's a whole nother story. But you've read any.
The biggest thing, Joe, probably is where your generation missed out a little bit. We didn't put enough sway on the younger elements, the under 16s, 17s, 19s, 20s, and making sure that you get your generation and probably my generation, especially before that, didn't get tournament understanding and knew what it was like to win a medal with an England shirt on, you know? We've got that now, and that's why we're seeing success at the senior level.
Yeah.
Before that, I don't think England managers really looked and thought there was an importance to how the under-17s, how the under-19s do.
Yeah, well, listen, well, I went and played in a sort of a World Cup when I was under 15 with England, and they put us in a youth hostel, where we had, it was basically soup and bread roll for lunch, and the FA dignitaries went and stayed in a 5-star hotel on a golf course. You know, but nowadays the lads, even under 15s,
yeah,
they get everything prepared right.
Yeah.
You know, and it, obviously it can make for them being feeling at ease, but also that's what they're going to get when they get there. You're going to get everything given to you,
yep,
but you've got to deliver.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, the generational change.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're on the right path. But you ended up, you also managed the Great Britain team, 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been you must have been so proud there, stepping out, and a big responsibility as well.
It was a political minefield, I've got to say, Joe.
I can imagine.
As you can imagine, we had...
I was up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know.
You had to pick
conversations with yourself. And
yeah,
as I say, we were allowed overage players, and that was the most difficult thing for me, making judgment calls on overage players, you know. I had to deal with... My bosses were the FA.
Yeah.
We also had a duty of care to the Scottish FA, Welsh and Northern Ireland FA, FIFA, UEFA, all of those things, Team GB, the London Organising Committee, so many people we were responsible to as well. The media thought it was a waste of time having a team in the Olympics. Some of the players thought it was a waste of time as well, and some really embraced it and wanted to be part of it, you know.
Yeah.
I know Wayne Rooney come up to me and said, are you the Olympic manager? And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, I said, why, are you interested? He said, yeah, I would be. So I had to fight a lot of the clubs to get release of players. So I had to fight the current England manager to get release of players as well. But the one thing I would say, Joe, is when we turned up as a group, as a squad, to be part of this massive worldwide umbrella, it was incredible.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was... For me, it was bigger than a World Cup as a player, 100%. You just felt as though you were showcasing your sport in a worldwide event, if you like. It was incredible to be involved in.
Oh, mate, I mean, I would have been one of them players who'd have been banging your door down to play. It didn't happen for whatever reason, but, you know, it was, I've got aspirations to coach, you know, I'm enjoying the media and everything, but I said I was just recently away on Chelsea's pre-season and watching Thomas Tuchel work. You know, it does give you the bug a little bit, and you think, right, you know, so I'm going to be doing, like you said, I'm going to go on courses and inset days, working days. But it's interesting what you say about Kevin Keegan allowing you into the board meeting, because no amount of coaching courses can get you that knowledge, is it?
No,
to be
it
a
can't.
Manager.
There's certain finite things. You've got to seek them out as well, Joe, to be fair. Like me sitting with a chief exec in the afternoons, I've got to give up my afternoon to sit with a chief exec and put myself at his desk and pick his brains. Same with board meetings, the same. When I was coaching with the first team, I used to go into the academy. So before I become manager, I knew that Stephen Ireland, Micah Richards, Nader Manua, all of these players are coming through. Yeah. And I also knew as well what coaches were good. So I knew Frank Bunn. I knew when I got a job, Frank was going to come up and join me with the reserve team, that type of thing. So it's great learning, but you've got to put yourself out and do the work. That's probably why I've just finished working with a man in David Moyes.
Yeah.
If you're a young coach and get the opportunity to work with him, he'll show you what it takes to be a top quality manager, work ethic wise.
Yeah, no, definitely for sure. I mean, so you stepped away from West Ham. What does the future hold? You've got the media career, but is there anything you feel unfinished business in management, or is it just ad hoc opportunities?
I've certainly not stepped away from West Ham to say that I'm never going to be involved in football again.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoy trying to improve young players. You know, so if anything comes up, I will certainly be looking at that type of thing. I mean, the phone went last week. I got a friend managing in a championship at the academy who says, look, come in, we'd love to have you in there. You know, these kids need to pick your brains, your experiences, and put a coaching session on and whatever. So if I have opportunities to go and do that type of thing or something that excites me, I'll certainly do that. But I also enjoy bits and pieces like this. I enjoy the media.
Yeah.
I go into companies. I do a lot of leadership, motivational speaking, which I really enjoy as well. So having a mixed bag of different things, I quite enjoy, Joe.
Right, quick fire questions, Piercy. Your favourite goal you've ever scored?
Diving header at Peterborough.
Yeah.
For Nottingham Forest, got us promoted back into the Premier League. And a year before that, I decided to, as England captain, to stay with Nottingham Forest and not leave them. So it symbolised a great deal for me and the fans. It wasn't a great goal, but it symbolised something.
Yeah, well, listen, diving headers going out of fashion. You don't see them anymore, do you?
Yeah, especially with my bonnet as well, fella, you know.
If you could go back to relive any moment in your career, what would it be?
I would be on a penalty spot in Turin and stick it in one of the corners when the German goalkeeper left his legs there.
Yeah, I think I'd be there with you. Best atmosphere you've ever played in?
Euro 96 for England.
Yeah.
In the stadium at Wembley for all the games. And it probably started a snowball from the time that Gazza scored his goal against Scotland. That atmosphere for the whole tournament was just incredible.
Yeah, I concur. I was in the crowd. Mm. Best player you've ever played with?
Paul Gascoigne. Most consistent, Des Walker, but the best, Paul Gascoigne.
Yeah. Couldn't have said a better player there for me. If you could name one player you would have loved to have played with but didn't?
The one I revered as probably the best player that's ever played football was Pelé.
Mm.
So I'd probably say Pelé because his ability to be fantastic was one thing, but he was also a team player as well. So I would say Pelé maybe.
Yeah, he was unique. Ice is a good one. Who's the best player you've ever coached?
I'm going to throw two in the mix there. And these two are individuals that have achieved way more than their ability. And that's not derogatory towards them. Yeah. It's the biggest compliment I can ever play a player.
Yeah.
That they've punched way above their ability. Yeah, and those two are James Milner and Jordan Henderson.
Yeah.
They're an absolute pleasure. Great professionals. Yeah. And you've only got to look at, you know, what they're achieving at the moment, the clubs they're at, the medals. Yeah. I don't think finance bothers them in the slightest. They're just ultimate professionals that drive their teammates on. And for me, they're an absolute pleasure to A, coach and be around.
Well, Piers, it's been brilliant chatting to you. You'll always be an England legend.
Cheers, Joe.
Good to see you, buddy.
And you, pal. BT Sport Pods.